er mennesker, og mennesker er makt. Denne uken er det Oslo Freedom Forum i Oslo. Hit kommer noen av de modigste aktivistene, menneskerettsforkjemperne i verden. Jeg fikk treffe Asma Khalifa, en ung kvinne fra Libya, som jobber med menneskerettigheter, som jobber som aktivist der, som vokste opp under Gaddafis regime, gjennomlevd krigen, har en sterk historie og er et av de modigste menneskene jeg har møtt. Her er vår samtale. Sometimes it's important to empower other people in order to get the power back to the people. How? For instance, by building civil society in a war-torn country. Asma Khalifa, women's rights activist and peace activist, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You told your story at Oslo Freedom Forum recently. We learned about the Arab Spring, the uprising and the wars from a young woman's perspective. What struck me the most was your description of the daily life with all the heroes trying to do their part to make society work still. And the story about yourself and your experience during the different parts of Libya's recent history. But first, tell me, how was it to grow up in Muammar al-Gaddafi's Libya?
Well, I was born into what is considered a minority, so I am not an Arab. I'm an Amazigh, French, or the colonial forces used to call us Berbers. I don't know if you're familiar with the term. They are the indigenous people of North Africa. So Gaddafi denied our existence when he took power. He called us an Arabic tribe that was taught a different language during the Italian occupation so that they could divide the society. So we were forbidden to speak our language, to practice our traditions, to even have our names. And the law still exists, actually, that there are no non-Arabic names allowed to be named. So it was my early experiences are at school when I couldn't speak proper Arabic.
Because you didn't speak Arabic at home?
No, yes. And the teachers would punish me. They would also call me names.
Like, what kind of punish?
They would make me stand outside the class for the rest of the period or take me downstairs to the principal so that he could also tell me a few words about how I am backwards and how I'm a barbarian and all of those things. And then I was in high school, and high schools in Libya were military based. So
you were wearing uniforms?
Yes, we dressed as soldiers. We were taught military. We had a military class every week.
What did you learn there?
They taught us different kind of bombs, hand grenades, different kind of guns. Sometimes they made us illustrate, so they taught us how to assemble. They assembled Kalashnikovs.
Was it boys and girls together in class or separate?
No, my school was only female, but there were other schools that are mixed-ish, I would say, because the classes still sometimes were gender segregated. But we studied politics from the age of 8. By politics, I mean Gaddafi's ideologies.
The Green Book. What was the Green Book?
The Green Book is Gaddafi's political ideology, or maybe I would say manifesto of the world, which is a strange mix of Marxism, communism, socialism, but it also criticized all of them.
What's the core message from the Green Book?
That there are no representation of people, that people should govern themselves without a central power.
But he was a central power.
Yes, but you know, we had testers. We had people who come to test us at school and ask us these sort of questions to make sure we got it. And the first thing they would ask you is that who rules Libya? And if you say Gaddafi, that's the very wrong answer.
It's the people.
It's the people.
So-called.
Yes.
You became a feminist quite early in life. What inspired you?
Well, my father was a very much a patriarch, an abuser patriarch. And I think it was me reading about the suffrage movement by accident in the school library and then understanding the power dynamic at home that I realized it was unfair.
Your mother, how was she? Was she accepting his patriotic style or was she protesting?
She was very much busy working. So I grew up in a household where my mother worked more than my father. So she wasn't around much. So she was working to raise us. But I think she was scared because society in Libya is very unforgiving for women. It forgives men for everything. They rape, they kill, they start wars, but they're still forgiven. But even saying no, even, you know, expressing contempt for the lifestyle, it makes you ostracized by everyone. I think she was scared also for us. She didn't want us to grow up with a mother who's deemed a divorcee because that's stigmatized. She thought then no one would marry the daughters. They will never have a normal life. So I think she was, I mean, my parents got divorced later, but I think at first she was scared that no one would support her and that she would be left alone. We were also seven.
So, seven kids?
Yes.
Most girls or boys?
No, three girls, four boys.
Did your mother support you in your feminism? Could you talk to her about it?
In the beginning, not so much, because I fought a lot with my father. And I think that the fighting all the time was, I'm sure, stressful for her and for my siblings who had to watch and hear it happen. I remember when I was 19, and that was the first time I traveled on my own against all objections, that she asked me, why are you doing this to me? And then I realized, because I always thought she wasn't supportive, but then I realized that she doesn't really understand what I'm doing. And I think I remembered I answered saying, I'm doing this for all of us because someone has to stand up to him.
Does she understand now? Have you been able to talk to her?
Yes. Now she's even running for elections in the local municipality.
So she's proud of you and you're proud of her.
I am.
You fought against sexual harassment during the Gaddafi years. How was that? That must have been quite rough.
Yes, it was. The system was so impossible to get through because every time you object something, they say, yes, you are right. In the Green Charter of Human Rights, you have this and that. Women are empowered. Women hold guns. Women have their own armed groups. Why are you... You know, there's nowhere to complain to because they tell you the system is you and you are empowered, so you don't need anyone. It is really difficult. There was a campaign to establish a hotline within the police system to improve response to domestic violence. And domestic violence is the biggest violence that women face, I guess, also in the whole world. That partners are the first perpetrators of violence against women. It is difficult for women to actually reach the police station. And if they reach the police station, which was also my experience when I went to testify against my father, that the police officer would say, but he's your father, why can't you sort things out with him? And they would do the same to women, that they'd say, but he's your husband, shame on you for bringing this to a police station. So we wanted to have female police officers who would be responsive to these. But yes, it is difficult when it's all men in charge that you try to penetrate the system.
So let's move to the new history, to the Arab Spring. What happened in your country, February 2011?
Well, we wanted to mobilize, inspired by Tunisia and Egypt. We wanted to mobilize to demand reform because we never imagined Gaddafi would go. I mean, he was the center of everything for over 40 years. And the structure he created actually only relies on him to be alive. That once he's gone, everything is destroyed because that's what he worked for. So the protests, as I said, never happened because then there was a protest that happened by women actually in Benghazi who demanded the bodies of their children from the massacre that happened in Abu Slim in 1996. That's a massacre that killed over 1,000 prisoners because they protested poor life condition in the prison. And then violence broke out at the other side of town. So there were police stations that were attacked and burned, and then of course, the system, the regime, responded with violence. And with violence, in 3 weeks, we were being bombed by NATO. So it was, there was no chance to mobilize or have a proper, revolution.
What's your opinion on the bombing of Libya back then?
I think back then, like a lot of Libyans, we were conflicted about it. I mean, a lot of us didn't want it, but a lot of us were very afraid for Benghazi and other places that would be wiped out. I think Libya is a failure of the diplomatic and foreign policy track. 3 weeks is not enough to pressure someone to leave or reinstate his son or change the system. I think everyone rushed to destroy and to drop bombs, and that's never good.
So what should they have done? They were afraid of a massacre in Benghazi?
Yeah, and later on, military reports show that he wasn't that close to Benghazi. When the resolution came out, which actually contradicts international law, it came out and the government issued ceasefire, but they bombed within hours of the ceasefire, so they never gave him a chance to actually show if he was going to have a ceasefire. NATO also stopped the African Union delegation to Tripoli to enter for negotiations at first. So they never want to hear him. And there was no representation of the Libyan government in the UN because the UN ambassador of Libya have turned against the regime. So there was no one from the Libyan regime abroad to discuss this.
So what would Libya look like today if there had been no bombing?
That's a very difficult question because a lot of us imagine that his son would have taken over, which is why me and a lot of other people were disappointed when his speech mirrored his father. We kind of still hoped that he would say something different and that there won't be any war. But, I mean, there could have been a transition to another system but it was obvious that he was wanted to be gone, and with him gone, everything else was destroyed.
When the uprising started, you worked nursing in one of the rebels' hospitals. What did you do there? What did you see?
Well, I trained first in the beginning, and I helped set up one of the small field hospitals in the city, which we didn't need because the rebels took over in one day. So I moved immediately to the military hospital where they needed people. It was a difficult time. I mean, wars from a distance or from TV is different from when you see it, you know. And images, not just of the mass graves we've received, a lot of them for almost 2 weeks, but also of mothers who lost her 4 sons, of the children who were playing in front of their house and one of them gets a stray bullet in the chest and he dies. The parents, the pain, and that happened on a daily basis all the time. We were attacked even sometimes in the hospital. But it is just terrible how much pain we can cause each other as human beings.
And you helped to sort out bodies, to help people find their relatives.
Yeah, when we received the mass graves, that we didn't have so many people who would be able to help. Especially not everyone was able to look at those bodies. And
you were?
Yes. I was always called the tough one at the hospital because I didn't shy away from anything. But also maybe it's not because I'm that strong, but maybe because I couldn't stop working. But yes, I helped families and friends identify the loved ones sometimes in the mass graves.
What did that do to you?
Well, it broke me. It is indescribable, the pain that you see when you can't see if it's your son or not. And there was one particular father who couldn't tell if it was his son or not because the body was decomposing. And he had a heart attack at the spot. So I had to move him inside the hospital. And then the brothers who identified their sibling and And you could see that there was some sort of hope fighting in their eyes when they hoped that he wasn't there, but they found him and they broke down. And it's really difficult when you're brought up in a society where men are not supposed to cry and supposed to be so strong that you see them fall apart around you.
You were signaling very strongly in that military hospital that you were not one of them. How did you do that?
Well, at the time, I was very angry. I've lost my best friend. My father, my brother and uncles were still fighting elsewhere in the country. I was seeing the pain of a lot of these people, of the mothers, of the parents, the siblings. And I felt hatred. I felt that Gaddafi forces were inhuman for what they've done. I dehumanized them. But then one night when I had the time, I reflected on it. I reflected about my feelings and I didn't think that I wanted to be that person.
So what did you hate. Do?
So I asked the doctor to make me to volunteer to be the nurse for Gaddafi's forces, where I only served them for a while. So I fed them, I cleaned them, I took them to the toilet, I gave them education, but I made sure they know which side I am on.
And then you met a young soldier.
Yeah.
What happened?
It was early in the morning, and I was giving a round of antibiotics. And they usually do not look me in the eyes, as I don't look them in the eyes.
They knew you were not on their side.
Yes. But he did. And his eyes looked like mine. I mean, I explain it in a way of bewilderment and grief that looked like mine, but they looked like mine. And I realized we're the same. We're Libyans going through this war that we didn't decide. We were on these both opposite sides. He probably had a lot of propaganda about us. I had a lot of propaganda about them. And at that time, we don't understand why it's happening, why it happened the way it happened. So I held his hand and we cried for a while. I think we cried for Libya, for all we lost and we will lose. And sadly, soon after that, it was my side that was committing the atrocities.
So you saw that both sides were bearing evil in a way.
I always say that in war there is no good or evil. There are no heroes and bastards, if you say. There is just war and it changes people.
So how did this change you? You decided to do something else?
Yeah, I left my post because I couldn't anymore be affiliated with people who sought freedom but then decided to inflict grief upon others. So I joined civil society because in government as a young woman, it wasn't possible really to exist. But in civil society, I was able to work with other young people to be active.
And what did you do? Civil society can be so much.
Yeah, I did so much. That is part of the trauma because you can't stop. I worked at a psychosocial center for traumatized children and youth. I met part of initiatives on youth empowerment, preparing for elections, on women's rights issues, especially after the war. Yeah, and of course, a lot of frequent protests on also the Amazigh question, the question of minorities and their rights and issues.
Did their situation change after Gaddafi fell?
Sadly, in the formal structure, no. But at the moment, because there is no government, there is no political power, de facto in Amazigh-speaking cities, people are teaching it. They've been teaching it for the past 7 years. All the young generation now reads and writes Amazigh and practices their language.
Your eyes sparkle when you say that. I can see it makes you very happy.
I love it because even though it's very negative everywhere around them, and they are rejected pretty much or used sometimes in the war propaganda, they are making the best of it. And that's something that inspires me immensely, the people who decide to build rather than destroy.
So the civil society work, you are sometimes in areas where it's no electricity, no internet.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Well, we do take our laptops with us, but I always know that we have to prepare it for the others. And I remember in one workshop with my colleague in the mountains, we only had an electricity for an hour and a half in the morning, and the rest of the day until we're finished with the workshop anyways, we didn't have electricity. So we continued without electricity. And when it's cold, which is quite bad, we just used blankets. But you do what you have to do and you continue work. You don't think about the things that might stop you, because if you do, you wouldn't do anything. You would give up.
And the security?
The security is quite bad. I mean, there is also restriction of movement. You go out of the city and there are checkpoints. Some of them are of criminal groups, some of them of armed groups. We were almost actually hijacked once, my friend and I, the car. It's not safe to travel, especially as women by themselves. It's really hard to describe here in Oslo how it is to go to a place where you know you have no rights.
Are you often scared?
Sometimes I think I am. I am often more scared for others. And when I have others with me, I think I feel less scared, because then I know that I would be thinking of how we get out of it together. But I think scared for me as a Libyan it means different than it is for you. Safety also means different.
I can imagine, definitely. In 2016, you received the Luxembourg Peace Prize as Outstanding Youth Peace Worker. And last year, you were named by the African Youth Awards as one of the 100 most influential young Africans. What does this kind of recognition mean for you and your work in the day-to-day life?
Well, I get very, very flustered, to be honest, because, it is of course really, really good and supportive to be recognized. But at the Luxembourg Peace Prize ceremony, I spoke then of civil society, as I did today, because I think it's not just me that does the work. It's the hundreds of us that are still working. So I'm very honored to be recognized, but at the same time I feel conflicted about it, because then there are so many others who are recognized, and I try then to use it to amplify their work and experiences.
You spoke to the Freedom Forum, so moving, about the daily life in Libya today, about all those people who work every day to keep life as normal as possible. Tell me about them.
Yeah, I spoke about what they don't tell about war, and that's something that I had to witness with my own eyes, because I also read so much about wars and seen so many movies. But they never tell you about those who continue to live through a war, those who don't know what will happen to them or their loved ones, but they still go to classes and work, the women who start up businesses and they are helping their communities, the students who continue their education and graduate in front of the bombed campus, the internally displaced who still teach their children to love this country that has rejected them. It's remarkable, really, how resilient human beings are. And despite the often Libya is described as barbaric in conditions, both to Libyans and to migrants and refugees, there's still amazing human being souls there, and that's what they don't tell you about the war.
So describe a normal day for a normal young girl.
So last month I was there mainly to meet with my friends and see my family. And my day was, we would go to our favorite coffee shop. That's where the coffee shop where a lot of activists meet. We'd have pancakes and cappuccino. Coffees in Libya are really, really good. That's one of the influences of the Italians. We would chat. Of course, our conversations always led us to the situation and what's going on. But we would sit in front of the coastline. Libya has really beautiful beaches. I would go with my sister around the city because I always like to see what has changed and what is different. I visit my friends' projects. Sometimes I go to internally displaced camps to see how it worsens, sadly, because it's not getting any better. But we would go afterwards to the DVD shop, pick up a movie, pick up more ice cream and decide to watch a movie.
So quite normal life.
Yeah.
In a very abnormal situation.
Yeah.
You also talked today about the trust issue, what war does to a country, with the trust, with the hate,
yeah,
tolerance. How has the Libyan society changed during these last years?
Libyan society in Gaddafi's era grew up to be wary of each other because during the 80s when he was cracking down on various movements, people reported on each other. And I'm talking about neighbors and family members. And if you reported someone who is anti the Jamahiriya, you could get awarded. You could get a car or money or... And that kind of thing made people paranoid and wary about their relationships and what they could say and what they could not. I mean, I grew up being told not to speak so loudly because the walls have ears. So I think the relationships were already tense. But in 2011, it was incredibly amazing because we truly were together. Sadly, it wasn't for the right purpose, but we were. It is very, very much amazing to stand in a protest of thousands of people and you know that you're all the same. But then the war happened and people are not trusting each other anymore, even worse. I mean, if I go in a room, I myself say it, I don't trust really people around me when I'm in Libya, because if I go in a room and I know and I see that it's only men, I get... I immediately want to see the exit strategy because I'm afraid I would I'd be attacked. And that's the same. You go to a checkpoint and you feel, okay, if I get asked any question, you know, how should I be prepared for this? What should I do? And that's not how you should be living with other human beings. You shouldn't be walking around people and thinking who is a rapist and who has a checkpoint and who is stealing. And
you always have to keep your guard up.
Yeah.
Is it more trust among the young generation or are all ages inflicted by this distrust?
I think it depends on from different groups to different groups. I mean, in civil society, even though it's also polarized a little bit, but civil society in Libya is still one of the least divided components of society. And so in that network, people are still willing to talk to each other, and that is a little bit of trust. But I would say in the street and elsewhere, you would see quite obviously that people from different ages do not trust anything.
Today, you live in Sweden, travel back and forth to Libya. Do you think Libya will be your home country anytime soon again?
I don't know if Libya wants me. That is also a thing. It's not just that I go away because I want to. It's also because it's a place where it doesn't really like women. It doesn't like minorities. It's not supportive. I mean, the difficult part about my work is that it's also the community that doesn't support you. It's not just that there are armed groups, there is war, and there are governments that are fighting. It's also that the community thinks you are bringing foreign agendas and you are teaching how to corrupt women and you are, you know, I'm trying to make women wear miniskirts, apparently.
That's the top of your agenda, right?
Yes. And that makes it difficult for you to continue to be with them as a society, because as soon as I moved away initially to do my master's, I had more energies to work. I was more burned out when I was inside Libya, when I was depressed a lot of the time and couldn't get out of bed and had to force myself. Because in protest, they would spit at us, they would throw rocks at us, they would call us sluts and whores. And that's just normal people, just people without guns. So you could imagine the rest, and it's difficult to live in that kind of environment. So I don't know, but I want to continue to support and help those who want to change.
And when you moved to Sweden, you live far away in the forest?
Yes.
How was it to come there from the noisy, busy, war-torn Libya?
It's very quiet. And it wasn't very good for my mental health, because I finally settled down and I had time to think about everything and all I've been through. Last year was also the year when my brother was kidnapped for 7 months by an armed group. It was a difficult, I think my first year was a difficult year, because I'm not used to this. I'm not used to things going well. And when I hear loud voices at the first year, and then even in Turkey, I would turn around and make sure I know what's going on and if it's something that I need to be careful about. New Year's Eve is always also challenging with all the fireworks, and I hate fireworks now because I can't deal with the sound. So it's interesting, but I'm liking it now.
Now you like the quiet.
Yes.
And now you have both worlds.
Yes.
The noise in Libya and the quiet in the Swedish forests. Do you see any hope for Libya?
As I said, when I see the people do these things, it gives me a spark of hope. But I think in the case of Libya, if we need to have hope again, we would need to work for it. We need to make it happen.
What can the West do? What can we do, if anything?
Don't forget about us, because we are the illegitimate affair, and Libya is never on the news, and it's never talked about, and it's not mentioned. In foreign policy, Libya is called the black hole, as in no one wants to go there, no one understands what's happening. But yes, keep us in your thoughts.
And in your work, is there anything anyone can do?
I would say, yeah, amplify civil society work and apply more pressure for civil society to be able to work without the fear. I mean, while I'm speaking now, there are hundreds of activists who are kidnapped and disappeared. Others have been assassinated during 2014 and afterwards. It's not safe for us to work. We've gone underground after 2014. But it's not mentioned how there is so little space for change to happen in Libya.
You're wearing a T-shirt today with a broken gun, broken
yes.
Rifle. Do you believe in nonviolence? Is it the path forward? Is it possible to reach goals?
Well, we've been war at 7 years and there is no resolution. So we might as well try something different.
Finally, the question I ask all my guests, what will be the story about you? Asma Khalifa, she was the one who...
I think survived, persevered, insisted, resisted, and still not only dreams, but plots. I plot.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to you out there listening, and thank you to our producer, Magne Antonsen. We will touch base again next time. Og helt til slutt vil jeg bare minne om at dere finner alle de gamle episodene på Acast eller iTunes med navnet Skartveit, og spesielt relevant denne uka, vil jeg si. Mitt intervju med Thor Halvorsen, grunnleggeren av Oslo Freedom Forum, som jeg laget i februar 2017, det synes jeg verdt et gjenhør. Han en imponerende mann.